So India's leader, Indonesia's leader, and China's leader came to the United States to meet with Obama in Washington, and they spent 2 days in Washington, each of them. And then each of them went out to Silicon Valley and spent a week. And that's really very telling to me about where the world sees America's importance. And it's no longer in Washington, it's actually out in Silicon Valley.
Amazing, it's quite extraordinary.
Hi, I'm Ted Zoller, and you're tuned into On the Heels of Innovation, a podcast powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. How is it that some people are successful in pushing their ideas further and faster than the rest of the world? What characteristics do they share? Which skills did they work to hone? And what lessons have they uncovered through each step forward and back that can inspire you to accelerate your own ideas for a business or venture? This podcast will explore the perspectives, insights, and journeys of innovators and entrepreneurs who combine creative thinking and perseverance to go beyond the expected. On the Heels of Innovation is powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project, which is a research initiative that I lead with my students in the Entrepreneurs Lab class at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, revealing the DNA that makes up successful entrepreneurs.
We're really lucky today to have a friend of mine, Almira Bayrazli, who is the author of From the Other Side of the World, Extraordinary Entrepreneurs, Unlikely Places. Welcome to Carolina.
Thank you. And it's great to be here.
I'm so thrilled to have an opportunity to help unpack some of the work that you've done, not only in your book, but in your life. And I was wondering, as a way to start out, so that the audience can be introduced to you and your work, could you say in your own words, what was your path and what have you learned in that path? So tell us your story.
Sure. It's a story that starts in Brooklyn, New York. It's a place that my parents, who are immigrants from Turkey, came to in the 1960s. And I was born and grew up there. And the great thing about growing up in Brooklyn is that you are constantly aware of the greater world because there are so many people from so many different places, whether it is Turkey or Bangladesh or India or Russia and China. It truly is a melting pot. So you're very aware of the greater world. And because of that, I was always curious about my classmates and the places that they came from, but also the place that my parents came from, which is Turkey. We would travel to Turkey on summer vacations when I was a child, and I could see how much my parents missed being there. And it was always a question I had of, well, if you miss it so much, why did you leave? And the reality was they left because there was really no economic opportunity in Turkey. And my life's passion really became, how do you make places like Turkey prosperous? How do you actually turn it into a place where people can have economic opportunity? And I wasn't thinking about it so much in terms of business or entrepreneurship. It was not something that was presented to me, but through government. How can I go work at the State Department and fix a place like Turkey and make it so that people like my parents don't have to actually go out and look for a better livelihood? And so that path, that passion led me to the State Department, which was the first place that I really worked out of college and graduate school. I got a chance to work for Madeleine Albright, the first Secretary of State. And I got to see policymaking, you know, on the front lines, which was fascinating. And then I got an opportunity to actually go and do the work on the front lines where I lived. I moved to Sarajevo, Bosnia Herzegovina, and got an opportunity to actually work on the policy in what I believed was what I wanted to do, which was actually change places like Bosnia and rehabilitate them and make them better.
Right.
What I actually saw was I got caught up in bureaucracy, and I got caught up in, no, you need approval for that. And I got caught up in, you know, paperwork, and it wasn't really what I had set out to do. I really set out to actually make an impact on people's lives and not sit in an office and push paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I left that And I came back to New York, which is where I found Endeavor, a nonprofit that supports entrepreneurs around the world. And I automatically fell in love with it because it did really marry my two passions of the wider world, but then also really making an impact on people's lives. And that's really where I learned all about entrepreneurship and meeting entrepreneurs from Mexico and Brazil and Uruguay and South Africa and Egypt and India, and really learning how those individuals were creating businesses in places where we normally don't think of entrepreneurship thriving.
It's truly unlikely places. And you set a context in every entrepreneur story that you unpack that shows kind of the reason why they were motivated, what were some of the obstacles and challenges they faced, and how they overcame those obstacles. And your basic takeaway, as I understand it, is that this is a global phenomenon. But people approach entrepreneurship in different ways around the world. Could you share with us a little bit of some of your experiences in telling these stories, and how are entrepreneurs different?
Well, I think entrepreneurs fundamentally are the same wherever they are, and they are individuals who are out there solving a problem.
Right.
It's not just setting up a business, and I think this is what sets entrepreneurs apart from someone who opens up a small business or somebody who works on Wall Street. If you open up a dry cleaner, yes, you're creating jobs and you're obviously, you're contributing to the economy, but you're not, I mean, I guess you're solving the problem of, where do I take my dirty laundry? Mm-hmm. But
the first world problem.
Right. It's a global problem. Where do I take my laundry?
Yeah, I guess it is.
But I think, entrepreneurs, I think it's the one thing that they share in common is that they're really out there trying to solve a problem. Whether it's to bring clean water to people, or whether it's to bring Wi-Fi, as I write it about in the first chapter of my book, an entrepreneur in Turkey does, or how people can pay for things more easily, like they do in certain places in Africa. And really, the thing that really opened my eye is that we think about entrepreneurship and we associate it with Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It's so closely associated with Silicon Valley, but the reality is there are more entrepreneurs outside of the United States than there are here in America.
I'm sure of it.
And one of the reasons that there are more entrepreneurs outside of America is because people have to create their own opportunities. So the problem that people are trying to solve is, how do I actually make a living? How do I actually make ends meet? Mm-hmm. And the real difference, I think, now that you're seeing over the past 20 years is now you're starting to see places like India and China and Nigeria and Mexico and Turkey actually produce the type of entrepreneurs you would normally see in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And the big difference is now they're actually scaling up. They're moving out of being necessity entrepreneurs, being entrepreneurs in order to live and survive, and actually going out there and solving problems on a scalable level where their enterprises are employing, thousands of people, but they're also attracting investments and transforming their communities.
Right. And this was somewhat refreshing from your time in government, where you felt that perhaps some of the bureaucracy bogged things down. And, people give a hard time to government sometimes, but, that is the rule, set of rules of the game. But entrepreneurs are pretty clever about circumnavigating those rules. Not to say they break them. They just operate with kind of a singleness of spirit. Is that what your experience has been?
Yeah, I mean, and I also, I don't want to, poo-poo the government. I think the government is absolutely 100% necessary, and I write about that in the chapter on Russia.
You do.
You need a strong government with strong rule of law in order to actually be a successful entrepreneur. And that's the one thing that sets the United States apart from a lot of countries around the world, is that we do have strong rule of law here and we have strong governance here, which is why entrepreneurs here have been able to succeed. Mm. And I think that entrepreneurs around the world, I think when you actually take a look, when entrepreneurs work within government and work with government, you really actually produce a lot of results. And so I think where entrepreneurs add value and complement government is that they're not waiting for the approval and they're not waiting for the process. They're just going out there and they're figuring it out. And in many ways, they actually, when they can actually collaborate and work with the government, they're actually solving a lot of problems and making lives better for a lot of people.
Right, and that's part of their passion. The worldview, and you use the word, for instance, necessity as kind of the first level, and then maybe opportunity being the second level, actually bringing about opportunity for others. You know, and I just want to probe this for a little bit. This notion of the person who gives themselves permission to go solve a problem. I find that when I travel around the world, there are some people that are programmed to think they've just got to fit in, and others who are willing to, and I'm using this term gumption, to talk about the person who says, I want to give myself permission to do something, you know, perhaps daring. Do you think that there's a function of gumption that plays out in every one of the stories that you talk about in your book and your own experience?
Yeah, I mean, I would call it chutzpah.
Chutzpah.
Because I'm from Brooklyn.
That's better. You know, chutzpah works.
Chutzpah. Because Yiddish is our second language in Brooklyn.
That's right.
Yeah, I definitely think gumption and chutzpah is a part of that characteristic. And essentially, and it's different. It's different for, I think, each entrepreneur. I don't think you can actually say every entrepreneur is the same.
Right.
But I think the one thing that they do share is that drive to actually do something outweighs the risks or the things holding them back.
Right. I understand that. And you know, I want to dig in a little bit in the characteristics you saw. You know, I came in with the assumption that entrepreneurs would be different because of their cultural background, because of how they were acculturated, how they were brought up, you know, the societal norms, difference in religion, difference in philosophical frameworks and things of that nature. But I'm curious if you found a commonality in characteristics common to most entrepreneurs. What would be the words you'd use to describe the entrepreneurs throughout the world that you've met that are common?
Resilient, mm-hmm. Patient, and persistent.
Wow, that's interesting. Resiliency makes sense. Patience and persistence, they're kind of at odds with one another. So unpack that for me.
Sure. So I think in terms of patience, entrepreneurs are probably impatient people because they go out there and they see something and they want to make it happen. But the successful ones are the ones that know that, you know, it's one foot in front of the other, and then you actually do have to wait. And not making progress is not necessarily a sign of a setback or failure. It's one of those things where, you know, you do actually need to be patient.
And let things catch up to you.
And let things catch up to you. So you definitely, I think the hallmark of a very good entrepreneur is one that actually recognizes that and is able to embrace patience.
Outstanding.
And persistence is where I've seen the most successful entrepreneurs are the ones that, despite being told no, despite being rejected, being told we can't fund you or no, that can't work, and you know, we don't think that this is a great idea, that they continue to do it because there is something that they do see and they believe in.
That makes complete sense to me. It's almost like I'm visualizing that they might see a North Star, they might see something abstract in the future, and they would like to get there. That destination, though, could be a long voyage, or it could be a short, very successful one, but they're prepared to stay on the path and be persistent to get there.
Yeah, and I think, and here it's important to say that North Star really is about solving the problem, and it's not about getting the money or the returns. Mm-hmm. And this is the big thing that I think distinguishes the successful entrepreneurs from the ones that don't make it, and it's the ones that really have a bigger vision. And it's, look, I come from a working class background. I think, like, making money is, you know, absolutely important. I'm not going to say, you know, it's not about the money. Yes, money is important. Sure. However, the ones that really do succeed and are the ones that actually make a difference, and they see their solution as being the thing that is actually going to really make a difference in the world.
You know, I'm curious when you really, what I love about your book is that you've examine the backgrounds and the stories of multiple entrepreneurs in different cultural contexts with different problem sets, with different issues that they all face. I'm curious if you saw that the experiences framed the entrepreneur, or did the entrepreneur frame the experience? what I'm trying to say is, does context define your objective? Do you find your problem based on the issues that are just around you? Is that a commonality in the people that you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely responding to their circumstances. And so, you know, in Nigeria, I write about an entrepreneur who is creating a mobile money app for Nigerians to be able to move money. Now, here in the United States, those apps came later and are actually not as well developed as they are in places like Nigeria or in Kenya, where they first actually came out with M-Pesa. And so there's a different circumstance, right? People, there's not a lot of financial infrastructure in a place like Nigeria. People don't have access to credit cards and bank accounts. And so it's a very big problem that needs to be solved. That's not going to be on the radar of somebody sitting in Silicon Valley or here in the Research Triangle or in New York where I sit. You know, it's what's in front of you and what is a challenge.
And how do you make the circumstance better for everyone?
Right, absolutely.
It's quite inspiring, as a matter of fact. Elmira, you've done a wonderful job in outlining stories of different entrepreneurs in different geographic contexts throughout the globe. We've talked about the commonalities. Have you noticed in their event histories periods of time when they thrived and periods of time when they maybe had setbacks or had suffered? And have you seen that as a common experience in all the entrepreneurs you've looked at, kind of cycles of breakout and cycles of setback?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's an entrepreneur alive or dead that has not experienced.
Are the obstacles bigger, though, and are the opportunities larger in the settings that you've been talking about outside of the U.S.?
You know, I think it's different. And certainly I think that when you're an entrepreneur in a place like Pakistan or in Russia or India, I definitely think that there are more obstacles over opportunity. And I think it is harder to be an entrepreneur outside of the Western world simply because it doesn't have a lot of the infrastructure, it doesn't have the capital, it doesn't have, you know, the governance and the rule of law and the institutions that entrepreneurs really need in order to succeed. And so the setbacks are always greater, which is why that I think that you haven't really seen the success stories in those places up until now. Slowly we're starting to see them. We're starting to see the so-called unicorns come out of China and India and a lot of other places around the world. But I think that there are greater setbacks. The one thing that I have seen that distinguishes entrepreneurs outside the United States with the ones here is that they're not disillusioned by the setbacks.
Right.
And we hear all the time here about, you know, fail fast, failure is okay. And right. While we do exist in a culture here in the United States where we accept failure, when it happens, we're not okay with it. And so I think in a place like Indonesia or in Turkey, when you fail, it's harder. However, you're more prepared for it, because things in those countries are just so much harder to begin with.
Right. As I look into kind of the pieces that go into developing the next entrepreneur, if you were to design a program to support the next generation of entrepreneurs, what ingredients would you include in that program? How would you think about a design to support the next generation of entrepreneurs?
I would definitely design a big library that is full of classics and works of fiction. And
imagination, is that the goal?
I do. I think that we approach entrepreneurship in this country very clinically as a business. And entrepreneurship is about solving problems. And when you read fiction and you're creative, a lot of the best writers are writing about conflict and how the protagonist is overcoming that conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the great entrepreneurs that I've come across, I mean, when you take a look at the story of Steve Jobs, a lot of his great ideas actually came through creativity. It didn't come through an economics class or through an accounting class, you know, the whole idea about the Mac computer and the fonts and having those fonts really came, you know, arose from him being exposed in Japan and the beauty of calligraphy. Oh, he took a calligraphy class at Occidental College, but then also the, you know, Japanese paying such close attention to detail in packaging and how things are presented. And I think that if I were to design a program, it would have a huge library with lots of books, both modern fiction, modern writers, but then also the classics. And I also would make sure that there was an opportunity to learn about different cultures around the world. Because again, reaching back to the Steve Jobs example, we get our best ideas from others. So this notion, this myth that the entrepreneur creates something alone in the garage, I think is wrong. The best entrepreneurs are ones that actually see something and they integrate it into the ideas that they've had. And I think that one of the reasons entrepreneurship has taken off in the world is because of globalization and because of technology and because we're able to actually connect with one another in a closer proximity. And so I can see something in Egypt or in Algeria or in South Africa, and I can see how they're using something, and I can integrate that into an idea that I might have sitting, you know, in Dubuque or in Chicago.
That makes complete sense to me. And it brings another question to mind. As you're looking at the differences in around the world, are you optimistic about the future? Do you think that the next generation sees entrepreneurship as a vehicle to solve some of the world's pressing problems? Because you're a student of those problems, and they're pretty huge problems as population increases, as we're dealing with, you know, challenges with sustainability of our planet, things of that nature. Are you bullish that entrepreneurism will be enough to overcome these challenges, and are you optimistic in general?
I'm realistic. And I think that entrepreneurs play a big role in pushing progress forward, but I also don't think that they're the only ones that can do it. And I think that we need to be realistic in terms and very open-eyed about the fact that a lot of the technologies that have been created are now being turned against, you know, people around the world. You see it happening in China, you see it happening in Iran and Turkey, where Russia, where there's a surveillance society. Mm-hmm. And I think where we need to be vigilant is that we just don't sit back on our laurels and think, well, entrepreneurs are now the new heroes and they're going to solve the problem. I think every individual needs to be aware about how does this new innovation, how does this new device factor into the greater world, which includes my, you know, the community that I'm living in, the economics of it, but also the governance of it. And how do I factor in there? And how does this impact civil society? So I think that I want to be sober and realistic about it. I am very optimistic in terms of it always is inspiring to me to see young men and women with wonderful ideas that they're excited about. But I also think that all of us in a community have a role in supporting and nurturing those individuals.
Well said, well said. Do you think that in your student of foreign policy, do you think in your lifetime you'll see entrepreneurism actually start to influence the public space and governance in foreign policy?
It's already happening.
It's already happening. Give us some examples.
It's already happening. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's happening. And the examples I probably will give is probably not... It's not happening in a positive way, but we are already seeing how technology and entrepreneurship have influenced. I mean, when you take a look at Facebook and the reach that Facebook has, it has a reach that is far greater than any one single country. Mm-hmm. And that reach has not necessarily been positive, primarily because I don't think Facebook has understood the responsibility and importance that its platform plays in a place like Myanmar or in Venezuela or in Iran. And I think they're starting to catch up. But also Google and Twitter. And I think that these companies have had a profound influence on our foreign policy that Washington and the State Department are unable to match. And they're not able to actually catch up fast enough in order to respond to it. So when you actually take a look in 2000 and I think it was 2016 or 17, I can't remember. So India's leader, Indonesia's leader, and China's leader came to the United States to meet with Obama in Washington, and they spent 2 days in Washington, each of them. And then each of them went out to Silicon Valley and spent a week. And that's really very telling to me about where the world sees America's importance. And it's no longer in Washington, it's actually out in Silicon Valley.
Amazing, it's quite extraordinary. So, you know, to take your words, persistence, patience, resilience, these are the things that I think we could all learn a great deal from. And thank you for bringing these lessons to us. Thank you, Elmira, for being part of the On the Heels of Innovation podcast.
Thank you, Ted, for having me. I'm so happy to be here.